something to believe in. This must be it, this must be freedom. Fly to me, fly to me, fly to me.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca. Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Today we are announcing campaign finance, bribery, and conspiracy charges against Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City. As the indictment alleges, Mayor Adams engaged in a long-running conspiracy in which he solicited and knowingly accepted illegal campaign contributions from foreign donors and corporations.
As New York City Mayor Eric Adams becomes the first sitting mayor in modern history to face federal charges, the city is alive with protest. We'll look at growing calls for Adams to resign, with New York State Assembly member Zohran Mamdani, who may himself run for mayor, and get details on the indictment from The Guardian investigative reporter George Joseph. His new article, A True Friend of Turkey, Eric Adams' bribery indictment reveals years of flights and favors. Then we go to Beirut to get an update on the ground as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refuses growing calls for a ceasefire from the United States, the European Union, France, and others, vowing to continue with full force. And we look at the anatomy of a smear campaign against Rashida Tlaib. We'll speak with Zateo's Prem Thacker and Steve Neveling, an investigative reporter with the Detroit Metro Times. All that and more coming up. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel continues to bombard Lebanon, killing at least 25 people so far today, including a family of nine in the border town of Sheba. Israel has killed over 700 people in Lebanon since Monday. In an apparent flip-flop, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Thursday evening he does support a U.S.-led temporary ceasefire effort, though he's done nothing to slow down Israel's assault, and Israeli officials have threatened to launch a ground invasion. Lebanon's Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib addressed the U.N. General Assembly on Thursday.
Lebanon is living through a crisis that threatens its very existence. The future of our people and our prosperity are in peril, and this is a situation that requires international intervention on an urgent basis before the situation spirals out of control with a domino effect, making the crisis impossible to contain.
The UN says some 30,000 people have fled Lebanon for Syria in recent days. Meanwhile, Syrian media says an Israeli airstrike from the occupied Golan Heights earlier today killed five Syrian soldiers on its border with Lebanon. Israel's assault on Gaza continues with another airstrike on a school sheltering displaced families in Jabalia, which killed at least 14 people Thursday.
Where are these people supposed to go? They're not here for leisure or fun. These are people whose homes were destroyed in the north, in Beit Lahia, Jabalia Base, Beit Hanun. This is a question for the international community, which has double standards. We demand the international organizations, the international community, the United Nations to provide us with safe places.
Israel's defense ministry said Thursday it secured another $8.7 billion in funding from the United States. Israel's killed over 41,500 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th and wounded 96,000 people, according to official numbers. More than 100 U.S. lawmakers have signed on to a letter by Washington Congressmember Adam Smith demanding an independent investigation into Israel's killing of the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi earlier this month in the occupied West Bank. Her family has also demanded the U.S. investigate after the Biden administration said it would instead rely on Israel's internal probe. She just graduated from the University of Washington in Seattle. A Cornell University student is facing deportation to the United Kingdom after administrators suspended him for taking part in a campus protest calling on Cornell to divest from companies that support Israel's assault on Gaza. Mamadou Tal, a PhD student in Africana Studies, says he would advise to leave the U.S. promptly after his academic suspension led Cornell's immigration office to cancel his F-1 student visa this week. Democracy Now! Spoke with Mamadou Tal on Thursday.
Yes, it's about freedom of speech, but that could not be divorced from Palestine. The issue why we're facing such repression and such repressive tactics is because it's about Palestine. It's because you're speaking anti-Israel, anti-Israel's genocide in Gaza. If these issues are not, like, separate. So absolutely, I think I'm a visible person. I'm quite outspoken on this issue. And I think this is the reason why I'm being targeted.
In related news, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri has declined the prestigious Noguchi Museum Award after the museum recently fired three workers for wearing a keffiyeh. Lahiri, who teaches at Barnard, was one of many academics who signed on to a letter in May expressing support for Gaza solidarity protests on campus. Protests targeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took place across New York City Thursday as he arrived in town ahead of his address before the UN General Assembly today. Yesterday morning, activists blocked traffic near the UN headquarters, unfurling a banner that read, "No war, criminals in NYC, stop the genocide," before police began arresting people. More protests and arrests took place throughout the day and into the night. This is Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink.
He's executing state-sponsored terrorism. The fact that he was allowed to land in this city and he is staying at a hotel and he is not arrested is a shame on everyone in power in the United States and in this city.
At the UN General Assembly, leaders of low-lying Pacific nations urged the global community to take decisive action ahead of a major declaration scheduled for 2026 on how the world will tackle sea level rise, an existential threat for many island nations. This is Feleti Teo, Prime Minister of Tuvalu.
We expect the declaration to include the following. Firstly, to ascertain the principle of statehood continuity as a tenet of international law and international cooperation, and to affirm that statehood cannot be challenged under any circumstances of sea level rise. Our membership in the United Nations and its specialized agency is permanent, notwithstanding the impact of climate change.
Hurricane Helene crashed into Florida's Big Bend region overnight as a Category 4 hurricane, bringing 140-mile-an-hour winds and record storm surge to the Gulf Coast. The storm rapidly moved inland and across Georgia, triggering flood and landslide warnings across the southern Appalachians. Up to 5 related deaths have been reported so far, and some 1.2 million people are without power. Sunrise Movement has welcomed the economic and climate proposal released by Kamala Harris this week as a, quote, significant step forward. The influential climate group said Harris's plan would help, quote, lower prices, expand green energy production, and create green union jobs, unquote, but called for even bolder steps to tackle the unfolding climate disaster. New York City Mayor Eric Adams said Thursday he's no intention of stepping down after federal prosecutors indicted him on corruption charges. This is Damian Williams, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
Mayor Adams engaged in a long-running conspiracy in which he solicited and knowingly accepted illegal campaign contributions from foreign donors and corporations. As we allege, Mayor Adams took these contributions even though he knew they were illegal. And even though he knew these contributions were attempts by a Turkish government official and Turkish businessmen to buy influence with him. We also allege that the mayor sought and accepted well over $100,000 in luxury travel benefits from some of the same foreign actors who arranged many of the illegal campaign contributions.
In exchange, prosecutors allege Mayor Adams helped Turkey's government open a new 36-story consular building near the United Nations without a fire inspection. We'll have much more on Mayor Adams' indictment, the first indictment of a mayor in New York City in modern history. Special Counsel Jack Smith on Thursday filed a 180-page brief detailing Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election, arguing his case in light of the Supreme Court decision this summer that granted Trump broad immunity against criminal charges. Federal Judge Tanya Chutkan will decide whether the contents of the dossier will be made available to the public before the November election. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has unveiled a Supreme Court reform bill that includes expanding the court by six justices, mandating audits for justices, automatically scheduling Supreme Court nominees for a Senate vote, and requiring supermajorities to overturn laws passed by Congress. Senator Wyden said, quote, "The Supreme Court is in crisis. More transparency, more accountability, and more checks on a power-hungry Supreme Court are just what the American people are asking for," unquote. President Biden signed a three-month spending bill Thursday, keeping the government funded through December 20th after Congress passed the bill on Wednesday. House Democrats backed the bill after Republican Speaker Mike Johnson withdrew a GOP and Trump-backed measure that would require proof of citizenship when registering to vote. President Biden signed an executive order targeting guns. Biden's order creates a task force to investigate new technologies, including 3D printed guns and machine gun conversions. It also orders the drafting of federal guidelines to limit the psychological harm to students of active shooter drills in high schools. President Biden said Thursday the U.S. will surge nearly $8 billion in new military aid to Ukraine, including long-range missiles. Biden made the announcement ahead of a meeting at the White House with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden reportedly did not grant Ukraine permission to fire U.S.-made weapons deep into Russian territory. Zelensky also met separately Thursday with Vice President Kamala Harris, who pledged unwavering support to Ukraine after the talks.
History has shown us if we allow aggressors like Putin to take land with impunity, they keep going. And Putin could set his sights on Poland, the Baltic states, and other NATO allies. Putin started this war, and he could end it tomorrow if he simply withdrew his troops from Ukraine's sovereign territory.
On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened to use nuclear weapons to respond to Ukraine's attacks on Russian territory if they're supported by a nuclear-armed nation. A Hong Kong court Thursday sentenced two editors of the now-defunct pro-democracy newspaper Stand News to jail time after their conviction last month on sedition charges. Chung Pui Kwen will serve 21 months. Patrick Lam received an 11-month sentence but will avoid jail on medical grounds. It's the first time journalists have been convicted of sedition since Hong Kong was handed over from Britain to China in 1997 and comes as part of Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong's autonomy. In Haiti, the UN says over 3,600 people have been killed in gang violence in the first half of the year. Earlier this week, Haiti's interim prime minister, Gary Conil, said his country is, quote, nowhere near winning this, as he addressed Haiti's spiraling security and humanitarian situation on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Despite the dire situation, the group Haitian Bridge Alliance said the Biden administration chartered yet another deportation flight with Haitian asylum seekers on Thursday. And new data from Argentina's statistics agency shows the country's poverty rate has skyrocketed to 53% after 6 months of the far-right libertarian president Javier Milei's austerity policies. That's up 11% since last year, as the number of people living in extreme poverty grew by 3 million during the first half of this year. This is Irma Casal of Buenos Aires, one of the many people who say they've suffered under the new government's economic shock therapy.
Since Milei's government took office, our work has dropped. We work twice as much for less, and we have to continue. At my age, I'm not getting hired anywhere else except maybe dragging a cart and nothing more. So I keep pushing forward.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. New York City Mayor Eric Adams is the first sitting mayor to face federal criminal charges. On Thursday, federal prosecutors formally announced charges of bribery and wire fraud in a scheme spanning nearly a decade. U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damian Williams, described the indictment against Adams in a news conference in Manhattan.
Today, we are announcing campaign finance, bribery, and conspiracy charges against Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City. As the indictment alleges, Mayor Adams engaged in a long-running conspiracy in which he solicited and knowingly accepted illegal campaign contributions from foreign donors and corporations. As we allege, Mayor Adams took these contributions even though he knew they were illegal. And even though he knew these contributions were attempts by a Turkish government official and Turkish businessmen to buy influence with him. Just because Adams received benefits for free, that doesn't mean that there weren't strings attached. As we allege, a particular Turkish government official behind many of the benefits Adams sought and accepted gave Adams all these things to gain influence over him. We allege that Adams knew that and took the benefits anyway. We allege that when the Turkish government official needed him, Adams also took corrupt official action in exchange for some of the luxury travel benefits.
In exchange, prosecutors allege Mayor Adams helped Turkey's government open a new 36-story consular building near the United Nations without a fire inspection. Adams also allegedly agreed not to release a statement on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, according to the indictment. Calls for Adams to resign have grown. Thursday, the federal charges against him were announced. Adams refused to step down during a news conference Thursday.
From here, my attorneys will take care of the case so I can take care of the city. My day-to-day will not change. I will continue to do the job for 8.3 million New Yorkers that I was elected to do.
All of this comes as thousands marched Thursday against Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's scheduled speech at the UN General Assembly today, also chanted their demands for Mayor Eric Adams to resign. For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic Socialist New York State Assembly member who's calling on Mayor Adams to resign and was also at Thursday's protest. He may run for mayor of New York. And George Joseph is with us, investigative reporter for The Guardian, who's been following all of this for years. His most recent piece is headlined, A True Friend of Turkey. Eric Adams' bribery indictment reveals years of flights and favors. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! So history is being made in New York. Eric Adams says he won't resign. George Joseph, if you can go through what this relationship is that Mayor Adams has with Turkey, what exactly these charges allege?
So this federal prosecutor's indictment alleges that going back years, members of the Turkish government and business leaders in Turkey with ties to the Erdogan regime used free flights, discounted hotels, luxury travel amenities, and numerous illegal straw donations coming from foreign sources in order to cultivate Eric Adams as the politician in the United States who would do favors for the Turkish government. And federal prosecutors allege that on several cases he did so. the most dramatic case being a situation in which there was a consular building that had serious safety regulations that needed to be pushed through so that it could be opened in time for President Erdogan from Turkey's visit. Fire officials were concerned about the timeline. They said there were major safety issues. But Eric Adams personally, according to prosecutors, pushed fire officials to get it pushed through. And he did so, they say, as a favor to Turkey.
So explain, they wanted, Turkey wanted to have this consulate ready for Erdogan, who was coming to New York. And talk about exactly who Adams put the pressure on and the fact of the Banks brothers, one now in charge of public safety, which is in charge of the fire department and the police department, what it meant to circumvent the rules for this building that did open in time for Erdogan's visit.
So what prosecutors allege is at the time of this building, a multi-million dollar building about to be opened, Eric Adams reached out to top fire officials and put pressure on them, saying, you need to make sure that you cut through whatever safety issues you have and get this opened. And that those fire officials then put pressure on their subordinates to cut through the normal safety processes that are important for all residents of New York to actually live in safe buildings so that the building could, in fact, be opened. And it was opened quickly on schedule in time for Erdogan's visit.
Despite the fact that there were, what, well over 60 violations found?
Correct. And you mentioned the police commissioner and the friend of Eric Adams, who he put in charge of public safety. Those guys are involved in a completely separate inquiry. There's actually probably four different federal investigations swirling around right now. The one we're talking about is just one of them.
So I just mentioned in the lead this whole issue of the Armenian genocide. What does Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, have to do with that?
Well, it's very customary for a leader of a major city like New York to express remembrance and solidarity for victims of genocide, such as the Armenian genocide. And because Turkey is so hell-bent on denying that genocide, according to prosecutors, after cultivating Adams, they pushed him not to put out a statement on that day to commemorate and honor the victims of that genocide. And they say he agreed not to put out that statement and then consequently did not do so.
One of the people in his inner circle was a foreign agent for the Turkish government before coming into that circle.
One of his longtime staffers, even before he became mayor, was a person that was sort of his liaison between the Turkish government and him. I don't know if we would use the term foreign agent for her, but yes, they had close ties.
What were you most shocked by? Unlike many others, you've been following this for years. And how did he develop this relationship with the Turkish government? And talk about Turkish Airlines and the flights that he took, no matter where he was going in the world.
What I was surprised by as a reporter that's been investigating these kinds of suspicious donations for years is that the prosecutor indictment actually has numerous text message exchanges involving Adams and Adams campaign staffers that are very explicit, suggesting or showing, according to prosecutors, that they knew that this money was illegal, coming from foreign sources and being passed through illegally through straw donors. So often in our investigations in the past, we've found a very suspicious indicia of straw donations, or we've had people admit to us that they were straw donors being used as pass-throughs illegally to flout campaign finance rules. But usually those have involved people close to the mayor. In this case, prosecutors are showing evidence that they say shows the mayor knew, accepted, and actively sought illegal donations from foreign sources.
And the person who I was talking about being a foreign agent, Mayor Adams, one of his press secretaries, Amaris Cockfield, registered as a foreign agent for the Turkish-U.S. Business Council, a group closely allied, right, with Erdogan.
Yes, and she is actually the daughter of a pastor who Eric Adams is a longtime friend with, who we investigated for a completely separate issue in which he also allegedly pushed city buildings inspectors to skirt building safety regulations on behalf of a yet another Eric Adams fundraiser, who is accused of yet another separate straw donor scheme.
So talk about the straw donors. Talk about the bundling of money as Eric Adams ran for mayor, what he revealed and what he didn't reveal. And also when it comes to gifts.
So New York City has a public matching funds program that's meant to help sort of strengthen our democracy by evening the playing field. What it does is small donors' donations are matched by public matching funds. But numerous donations that Eric Adams made according to prosecutors were actually straw donations, donations that were coming from wealthy individuals but being framed as if they were coming from small-time donors. Those small donations allowed Adams to access thousands of extra dollars, millions, in fact, in total, in public taxpayer-funded matching funds. And that was a large part of why he had the biggest campaign war chest going into the 2021 mayoral election.
Zoran Mamdani, you may run against the mayor. You're a New York State Assembly member. You were part of the protests yesterday. Can you talk about, first, your response to the indictment? One of the things we've seen over the last weeks, months, and maybe, George, you'd first like to comment on this, is the seizing of cell phones, the iPad of Eric Adams. This is well before this indictment was announced, making it difficult, actually, for many people to reach commissioners, because so many of them, what is it, something like 15 people now in his inner circle and in his cabinet have had their electronic devices, their communication devices seized.
This is unprecedented in a generation in New York. We have people at the top rungs of the police department, the education department, city hall. They're all having their homes raided, phones seized. They're not at work. They're busy focusing on their legal matters. You know, this is a generational level scandal for New York City.
Zoran Mamdani, your response.
I think it's an incredibly disappointing day, but it's sadly one that is not surprising. We have known for many years that Eric Adams has been investigated at multiple levels of government, even when he was just a candidate for mayor. And one of the things that we feared was that big donors and special interests supported him because they knew that he was vulnerable to access and influence in the manner that we're now seeing in these federal allegations. And I think in this moment right now, it is impossible for the mayor to perform his duties as the leader of a city of 8.3 million people, especially when, in his own words, he said he's going to spend every ounce of strength and spirit in his body fighting these charges, which begs the question where that leaves New Yorkers, the 300,000 municipal workforce he's supposed to lead, or the more than $100 billion budget that he is supposed to manage.
So what about that? How is the government functioning right now? It's very interesting that in fact, and this isn't true across the United States, the governor of New York, Governor Hochul, has the power to fire, essentially, Mayor Adams, to force him out.
She has the power to remove him. And, you know, the question here is there is a standard for that removal. We are currently calling for him to resign because of the fact that we know that this mayor is unable to meet this moment and hasn't been able to meet this moment for weeks and months, frankly, prior to this indictment. You know, the same mayor who is now being alleged to have received over $100,000 in bribes was just last week praising New York police officers for opening fire on four New Yorkers at a subway station over the crime of stealing $2.90 in a subway. Fair. This is the mayor that we're talking about.
And there's another entity that has the ability to basically remove Mayor Adams as the mayor of New York. It's the Inability Committee.
Yes, these are the first time that many people are learning about this kind of a committee. It's included in the city charter. I think, however, that the likelihood of removal from that committee is a little lower, given the fact that my understanding is that it requires four out of the five members of that committee to vote for his removal. And of those five members, two of them are appointees of Eric Adams.
So State Assembly Member Zoran Mamdani, can you talk about why you were out in the streets yesterday? There was a kind of converging of issues, the demand for Mayor Adams to resign and Netanyahu coming to the United Nations, the prime minister of Israel, as the assault on Gaza and on Lebanon continues.
You know, I think these two events are united in one fact, which is a crisis of faith in our government. As New Yorkers look to City Hall being rife with corruption and see a municipal government that is unable to meet their most basic needs, they also look at a federal government that continues to greenlight billions of dollars in funding for an Israeli genocide of Palestinians and a military bombardment that has now spread into Beirut and other parts of Lebanon. And so I joined with thousands of New Yorkers yesterday marching in opposition to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, because we understand that these two things are related in that they are both displays of a bankruptcy of leadership. And what we need to see is a vision that is worthy of New Yorkers' belief and Americans' belief. And that vision has to be one that meets their needs, as opposed to telling them there isn't enough money for you here for everything you need to live a dignified life, but we have enough to kill children abroad.
In a moment, we're going to go to Beirut to get the latest. But when you were on the streets, this isn't the first time you've protested. I interviewed you at Grand Central many months ago. Large contingent, about 1,000 people, mainly Jewish New Yorkers, who were protesting Netanyahu. Many people got arrested there, hundreds. You weren't getting arrested because you'd been arrested, what, the week before? Was it in front of the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's house?
Yes, yes. I was arrested in front of the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's house with hundreds of other New Yorkers, most of whom were Jewish, in saying that do not use their pain for the justification of more of exactly that. And we've sadly seen over these many months an expansion of the very war crimes we were hoping to prevent.
And you were also one of the sponsors of the Not on Our Dime bill in the Assembly. Where does that stand right now, and what is it?
So that is a piece of legislation that I introduced in the State Assembly in 2023. Jabari Brisport, a state senator from Brooklyn, introduced it in the state Senate. And it's a piece of legislation that would make it illegal for New York charities to fund Israeli war crimes, whether they be taking place across the West Bank or in Gaza. And the reason that it's necessary is that we've found that New York charities have been sending more than $60 million a year in violation of international law and in violation of the spirit of New York law. And we need to make that explicit now in our state's laws.
So are you going to run for mayor of New York?
I am considering doing so. It is something that is, in my mind, a possibility because of this very fact that New Yorkers are not just suffering from a crisis of faith because of corruption, but also a crisis of faith in their government because of a cost of living crisis that Mayor Adams himself has exacerbated. And when they're thinking about their inability to afford their rent, inability to afford their utilities, their bus fare, whatever it may be, they are looking for affirmative proposals that are clear and explicit. Those are things that I think I could offer in this race. And they're also looking for someone who understands that this crisis of faith is taking place across multiple levels of government and needs to have a vision that encompasses all of that.
And if you do run, that you might be running against the disgraced governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who was forced to resign and now may run for mayor of New York City?
Yes. And the issue here that we have to remember is that it's not just Eric Adams that got us to this point. It's real estate developers, big donors, the New York Post, all of whom heralded Eric Adams as the savior of our city. Those same people see in Andrew Cuomo the same opportunity to reap benefits. And we know that we do not want to exchange one disgraced executive of New York City for another disgraced executive of New York State. It's time we turn the page on these kinds of leaders and on the influences that brought them to bear.
And Mayor Adams claiming that he is a target?
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, he is a target in the sense that he has allegedly committed crimes. That is the reason that he is a target. But what he is looking to do is exploit New Yorkers' rightful fears about government persecution and exploit them to apply them to himself, when in fact he is the only person that brought him to this place.
And finally, George Joseph, what happens next?
So today, Mayor Adams is going to have his first court appearance, and he's expected, obviously, to plead not guilty. And then we're going to have a prolonged court process as the primary starts heating up. So we're going to see what happens, whether Governor Hochul does really consider removing Adams from office, whether there's pressure on her to do so, who else is going to jump into the race. A lot is in the air right now.
We want to thank you both for being with us. George Joseph, investigative reporter for The Guardian. His article will link to A True Friend of Turkey. Eric Adams' bribery indictment reveals years of flights and favors. And Zohran Mamdani, New York State Assembly member. Next up, an update from Lebanon. Stay with us.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere.
New York, New York by Frank Sinatra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We go now to Lebanon, where Israeli strikes have already killed at least 25 people today, including a family of nine in the border town of Shabah, bringing the death toll to over 700 since Israel began its indiscriminate bombing on Monday. Israel strikes follow a series of explosions involving booby-trapped pagers and walkie-talkies in Beirut and southern Lebanon last week that killed at least 37 people and injured more than 35. In an apparent flip-flop, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel shares the aims of the U.S.-led initiative for a temporary ceasefire, which has also been backed by France, by Canada, by Saudi Arabia, by UAE, by the European Union and others. This comes after Netanyahu had publicly rejected the ceasefire proposal and vowed Israel will carry on with full force attacks on Lebanon. Netanyahu spoke Thursday as he landed here in New York, where he's scheduled to address leaders of the UN General Assembly.
My policy, our policy is clear. We are continuing to hit Hezbollah with full force, and we will not stop until we achieve our goals. First and foremost, returning the residents of the north safely to their homes.
Netanyahu's remarks came as the Israeli military reiterated its troops are preparing for a possible ground invasion of Lebanon if tensions continue to escalate. Earlier today, Israeli tanks and armored vehicles were seen crossing Israel's northern border into Lebanon. Meanwhile, Lebanese officials say the number of displaced people fleeing Israel's attacks has likely surpassed a quarter of a million, with tens of thousands sheltering in evacuation centers, in schools that have been closed in Beirut and across Lebanon. Speaking at the UN General Assembly Thursday, the Lebanese Foreign Minister, Abdullah Bouhabib, urged all parties to agree to a ceasefire. He said the worsening violence threatens Lebanon's very existence. He said a U.S.-France-led proposal for that temporary truce was an opportunity to generate momentum to take steps towards ending the crisis.
Lebanon is living through a crisis that threatens its very existence. The future of our people and our prosperity are in peril, and this is a situation that requires international intervention on an urgent basis before the situation spirals out of control with a domino effect, making the crisis impossible to contain. It will be impossible to extinguish the flame of this crisis, which will transform into a black hole that will engulf regional, international peace and security. The crisis in Lebanon threatens the entire Middle East if the situation remains as it currently is and if the world remains immobile.
As the Biden administration claims it backs a ceasefire in Lebanon, Israel says it's set to receive a new military aid package from the United States totaling some $8.7 billion. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Mona Fawaz, professor of urban planning at American University of Beirut. She's also an activist. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what's happening on the ground with tens of thousands of people taking shelter in schools and other places, a quarter of a million people displaced? You yourself are involved with helping to house people. What's happening?
Hi, Amy, and thanks for covering all of this. So really, everyone here in Beirut is under—actually, in Lebanon is under extreme duress. Since Monday, we've had more than—the Ministry of Health just announced 747 deaths. That is, in 3 days, actually, more than half the people killed back in 2006 during the entire war. That means that people fled the south really very, very quickly, and the Beqa. And so the normal trickle-down is instead huge flows of people who were traveling across stranded roads, spending hours and hours on trips that normally would just take 45 minutes. And of course, people are fleeing because they've just been watching for a whole year a genocide unfold in Gaza. And they've been hearing members of the Israeli political class and the generals repeating over and over again that they're turning Beirut into another Gaza. So that means that people are really scared, and Israel is pounding the south and the Beqa with one raid after another. And they're also deploying all sorts of tactics to scare people, throwing leaflets, taking over the public phone station to robot call people and issue calls telling everyone to evacuate our classrooms, our homes. Everyone was getting these calls on Monday and Tuesday. So it's really a lot of stress that you have to deal with in the background of a country that for the last 11 years have suffered one shock after the other. So that population, one in five of whom is actually still a Syrian refugee, has also lost 80% of its population is below the poverty line since we went bankrupt in 2019. We haven't had a president since for two years now, actually. So there is, we have had to basically try and help each other in a context which is really very severe. And as you pointed out, the schools are closed, our kids are home because the schools are being used in shelter. One in two schools in Beirut is actually a shelter right now, and more than 40% of all the public schools in Lebanon have been turned into shelter. And it's getting closer and closer to us. I mean, Israel does these so-called targeted assassinations, which sadly much of the Western press has been celebrating, and they talk about Israelis' ingenuity. In fact, I mean, it's targeting everyone. It's touching everyone. Just yesterday, there was an attack in Beirut, and it wounded one of my architecture students, and a fourth-year architecture student at the American University of Beirut. So, I mean, these are not fighters. These are civilians. She just lived on the wrong street because Israel decided to do that. Last Monday's attack killed about 50 people. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to show the extent to which people are trying to get involved, make a difference, help each other, but really in a very, very difficult context. And yes, of course, most of the people I know are actually involved in trying to help people. So most of us are sheltering family members or friends or people we know in our own homes. We also are fundraising for the civil defense because Israel's been actually targeting ambulances, claiming that the wounded are fighters. But that means that the civil defense, which is basically the first responders, are losing their lives and their ambulances. And so we're trying to fundraise for them. We're trying to fundraise for medications. And because I work in a lab that normally would do a lot of urban visualization on housing and rent, we're actually really mapping the violence and then also all the schools. schools and trying to coordinate the action of solidarity by showing where the schools are, who can take aid where, so as basically the university can play that role of coordination and support for solidarity movements.
Israel says it's warned tens of thousands of people, I think even the information minister of Lebanon, to move. They say anyone who's living near a Hezbollah facility or where weapons are stored, how do people know this, Professor Fawaz?
Of course, people cannot know where Hezbollah has weapons. And of course, Israel can claim anything it wants. In fact, they've been sending bombs in all sorts of neighborhoods and areas of the country where it's very unlikely that Hezbollah has any weapons. And the point is to basically set people against the party and to basically make it seem as if the war is just the result of Hezbollah's belligerence. In practice, there has been ridiculous videos showing people hiding weapons under their mattresses. It's actually really condescending picture cartoons oriented towards the Lebanese people, telling them, hey, you know, the person who hid the bomb under your sofa, do you remember that guy? He was a Hezbollah. This is ridiculous. I mean, people don't know, and that is actually increasing the fear. And it's basically meant to be divisive because the Lebanese society at the base is already quite divided on many issues, and also to put people under more duress, to just say, okay, we surrender, you can do whatever you want. No one can ever say no to mighty Israel, and it's sponsors.
Finally, you're a professor of urban planning. Can you explain the scale of the destruction in Lebanon due to Israel's attacks right now? You're documenting the frequency of the attacks, the demolition of infrastructure. We just have a minute.
Well, since last October, we have been documenting the strikes on a daily basis and showing where they go and how, and our evidence is very clear. It shows that Israel has hit Lebanon until last week four times more often and way deeper. In the last week, of course, the numbers have gone up the roof, and it is impossible to count how much of the demolition has actually happened. So we are working to geosat that, because as in previous wars, we will have to support the effort of reconstruction. But some of the villages on the edges of Lebanon are basically fully flattened.
I want to thank you for being with us, Mona Fawaz. Please stay safe, professor of urban planning at the American University of Beirut. Next up, we look at the anatomy of a smear campaign against Rashida Tlaib. We'll speak with Prem Thacker of Zateo and Steve Neveling, an investigative reporter at Detroit Metro Times. It all started with an interview the Detroit congressmember did with the Detroit Metro Times. Then CNN got a hold of it. Stay with us. Holding the light through your finger, hoping it won't fade away. Darkness around seems to linger. It sticks with me. Hold on to me, Nemesis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how key members of the media have participated in a smear campaign against the only Palestinian-American in Congress, a vocal critic of Israel, Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib. She recently criticized Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, who is Jewish, over charges Nessel filed against 11 mostly students and alumni who were involved in a pro-Palestine encampment at the University of Michigan. The Detroit Metro Times reported the comments by Tlaib from an exclusive interview Friday, September 13th, saying Nessel's move was, quote, going to set a precedent, and it's unfortunate that a Democrat made that move. We've had the right to dissent, the right to protest. We've done it for climate, the immigrant rights movement, for Black lives, and even around issues of injustice among water shutoffs. But it seems that the attorney general decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently. And that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs, Tlaib told the Detroit Metro Times. Well, the Michigan District Attorney General, the Michigan Attorney General, Dana Nessel, responded in a post on X that also referred to a recent Detroit News cartoon that was widely condemned as racist and Islamophobic for showing Congressmember Tlaib next to an exploding pager implying she was part of Hezbollah. Nessel wrote, quote, Rashida's religion should not be used in a cartoon to imply that she's a terrorist. It's Islamophobic and wrong, just as Rashida should not use my religion to imply I cannot perform my job fairly as Attorney General. It's anti-Semitic and wrong, unquote. After this, the Metro Times published a fact check Monday, noting Tlaib, quote, never once mentioned Nessel's religion or Judaism, even though the newspaper had pointed out in its own reporting that Nessel is Jewish. Meanwhile, the smear campaign was picked up over the weekend by CNN's Jake Tapper. This is Tapper interviewing the Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer Sunday on CNN's State of the Union.
Do you think Attorney General Nessel is not doing her job? Because Congresswoman Tlaib is suggesting that she shouldn't be prosecuting these individuals that Nessel says broke the law, and that she's only doing it because she's Jewish and the protesters are not. That's quite an accusation. Do you think it's true?
Like I said, Jake, I'm not going to get in the middle of this.
Even as Governor Whitmer refused to take the bait, CNN correspondent Dana Bash also accused Congressmember Rashida Tlaib of anti-Semitism. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Prem Tucker is with us, political correspondent, columnist for Zatteo News, whose recent piece is headlined Anatomy of a Smear Campaign Against Rashida Tlaib. And in Detroit, we're joined by Steve Neveling, investigative reporter at Detroit Metro Times, who wrote the story this week, headline Fact Check, Tlaib did not say Nessel charged pro-Palestinian protesters because she's Jewish. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Steve Neveling, let's begin with you, since that's where it started. Talk about your initial interview with Rashida Tlaib and then how it was characterized and the fact check you've tried to do since then.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk to Rashida Tlaib as the only Palestinian American in Congress, and I wanted to find out what she thought of Dana Nessel's decision to arrest or to charge these 11 protesters, because it was so unusual. And we talked for about 20 minutes in a phone interview, and it was very clear to me during our discussion that she was talking about— when she was talking about a bias in the Attorney General's office, she was talking about an anti-Palestinian bias. What she pointed out was something that's very common across many institutions in America, many of which aren't led by Jewish people. So she wasn't ever making this sort of issue of what Dana Nessel's religion was. She was just saying that there's this anti-Palestinian bias, and pointed out that in the 6 years that Dana Nessel has been Attorney General, she has never once charged a protester for anything. And I've been to dozens of protests in the last 6 years. A lot of them had civil disobedience that was a lot more severe than what we saw at the University of Michigan. So it was very bizarre. And I wanted to find out what Rashida Tlaib thought about that. And we had the interview, and I thought it went well. I wrote the story, and then the next thing we know, it ends up getting misinterpreted and lies are peddled and it gets out of control.
Well, talk about how that happened. Talk about the interviews on CNN and then what you tried to do with your tweets, with your articles.
Yeah, I started seeing messages from Jewish groups, from ADL, from a state lawmaker, from people saying this was anti-Semitic. She's saying that Rashida Tlaib is saying that Dana Nessel is only doing this because she's Jewish. And then CNN picked it up, and Jake Tapper was saying, you know, that this actually happened. This is what she said. And she never said it. So I felt an obligation and I felt some of a responsibility because my story was being misinterpreted and Rashida Tlaib, as a result, was getting labeled as an anti-Semite. So I thought it was my responsibility to let CNN know, to let all these other people know that this is not at all what happened. She's talking about an anti-Palestinian bias. And I went on Twitter, on Jake Tapper's page, and on some of the other reporters' pages and said, this is what happened. We wrote a fact check saying this is not at all what happened. And it took a good 24 hours after that before CNN decided to say, okay, yeah, we made an error. But by then, the damage had already been done. You have Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American in Congress, getting accused of being an anti-Semite, which really diminishes what she says about this this war. So, I mean, it was a very unusual, surreal experience for me as a journalist to see so many lies being peddled about an interview that I witnessed and people saying that something happened that I know didn't happen.
Prem Tucker of Zateo, can you take it from there on a national level, watching this story unfold with the reporter himself trying to correct the record, saying that the Congress member who he interviewed never mentioned what CNN and others said she did, and then trying to bring the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, into this?
Thank you, Amy. And Steve, it's a pleasure to be here with you, too. Seeing it from the D.C. perspective, it was remarkable to watch the timeline and events unfold sequentially. This started out, actually, a day before Steve's interview, when Representative Tlaib appeared at a Black Palestine Solidarity panel, when the charges by Nestle were announced minutes before this panel. So during the panel, Representative Rashida Tlaib speaks out against them. She sort of criticizes Dana Nestle for not bringing to charges charges against those involved with the Flint water crisis, but nevertheless choosing to do so here. As Steve mentions, also contrasting that with other civil disobedience and other civil actions where people were not charged. Notably, too, is that, as I believe Steve noted, too, that Representative Tlaib was also suggesting that perhaps there might have been pressure from the university. And so, over and over again, it seemed that Representative Tlaib was referring to broader systematic forces that are, as Steve says, anti-Palestinian. But again, the timeline itself is also quite striking. So there's the panel on the 12th where Representative Tlaib makes these comments condemning the charges. On the 13th is when Steve's story comes out with Representative Tlaib. On the 20th, a week later, is when the cartoon is out, when Dana Nestle tweets condemning the cartoon, but also condemning the possibility that or suggestion that she is only making these actions against these pro-Palestine protesters because of her Jewish identity. A few days after, or actually that same day, is when Jake Tapper then asks Governor Whitmer about the situation and starts peddling this false accusation against Representative Rashida Tlaib. And then you see Jewish Insider report on that exchange, and then the Anti-Defamation League peddled the defamatory claim about Representative Tlaib. Then you see Steve putting out his fact check as more and more anchors and reporters continue to peddle this lie. And you just see this sort of unfold and evolve in real time, as I can only imagine Steve's experience as someone who witnessed this, seeing the story be misappropriated and taken out of his own hands as someone who wrote the story. It's very remarkable. And though some reporters have backtracked, some others, including the ADL and Jonathan Greenblatt of the ADL, have sort of continued on with sort of pushing the suggestion that somehow Rashida Tlaib was criticizing these charges on the basis of Dana Nestle's identity and not the anti-Palestinian bias that Steve speaks to, not potential broader systematic forces that are anti-Palestinian in nature.
Prem, before we end the show, I wanted to ask you about a story you've been following closely. Last month, your story was headlined, 200 Days and Still No Justice for Hind. It featured a video of the many times you've tried to ask the State Department for an update on the status of the Hind Rajab investigation. That six-year-old Palestinian girl, Hind Rajab, killed on January 29th in an Israeli attack, along with six members of her family. They were in a car. They were desperately calling to the Red Crescent and saying that they were under attack in a car. Two paramedics got permission to go to try to help them. They also were killed in the Israeli second strike, what the experts say may amount to a war crime. This is you questioning State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel.
So has the Biden-Harris administration followed up on this alleged lie by the Israeli government or sought to confirm any of Israel's claims on the half-year-old killing now of this girl and her family?
So we are in touch with our partners in Israel around the clock on a variety of issues. I don't have any specifics to read out as it relates to this conversation. I'm happy to check if there have been any additional updates. But to my understanding, this investigation is still ongoing, and I will leave it to them to speak to the details.
So I had reached out to the Israeli government as well, and while I was reaching out to the Red Crescent, and they said they would get back to me with an answer, and that they did not. After we reported, the Red Crescent said that this government gives them billions of dollars in aid. I imagine that such claims would want to be fact-checked.
So we will continue to engage with our partners in Israel. We ask them for additional information. We ask questions when we see incidents unfold, and we'll continue to do that. As it relates to this incident, I'm not aware of any updates, and I believe this investigation is ongoing.
That's State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel being continually